Mission. This is take one, side B of the interview with Professor Butlin. We'd got you back to the University of Sydney, or you were just about to become a staff member of the University of Sydney.
Well, when I got back to Canberra, I was assigned the task of two main tasks, I guess. One was to take over Finn Crisp's job as secretary of the committee establishing the ANU, and the main one, was to plan for decontrol after the end of the war. And the decontrol job meant going through every individual regulatory device that had been established during the war and give it a priority rating to decide whether it should be dropped the day the gun stopped shooting, or a week after, or a month after, or 6 months after, or a year after, or maybe held and conceivably put into a referendum to be retained as federal control. I spent 6 months on that, and an enormous dossier. In due course, went up to Cabinet. Cabinet looked at it for about 10 minutes and said, "Bullshit. We want five controls: capital issues control, prices control. I forgot what the other three were. Forget the rest." And that again shows something of the public service. One really doesn't control what one's doing. And not that sour grapes. The politicians were quite right in acting as they did, but it did have an impact on not only me but several people who were enthusiastic about not about controls, but in this case, but about how far the shape of society and the economy after the war was going to change. And it was made very explicit as a result of that cabinet meeting that we were not going to have anything other than the essentially old-style capitalist society that we had known before the war, with a little bit of government intervention. And that really turned a lot of people off post-war reconstruction, certainly including me. So anyway, a job was advertised at the university, lecturer in economic history. I was getting, I was then age 25, I was getting then the equivalent of what was then a professorial salary in public service. And this lectureship was offered slightly below the basic wage. And I took it with great gusto, and I've never regretted it ever since. It was the first time a job had been advertised in economic history as such, as at a lecturer level in Sydney. So I took it.
And you responded with enthusiasm to that advertisement. Your disillusionment was complete before that final disillusionment with the reconstruction.
Oh, yes. Well, but let's not stress the disillusionment too much. I always wanted to be an academic, so I remember Trevor Swan wanting me to stay on, offering me all sorts of things if I did stay on, and wondering at the time whether I should really go and work for my brother. I didn't realise what that implied at the time.
I think this is your brother Sid.
My brother Sid, yeah. But I was determined to go, so I went.
When was that pressure that you speak of, Trevor Swan urging you to remain?
That would have been the end of 1945.
When you were in Washington?
No, at the end of 1945, I was back from Washington, I think, in mid-1945. Yes, that's right.
You took over from Finn Crisp in a secretarial role relating to ANU, which I'd forgotten. But before we get to that, which we'll have to look into as closely as we can you recall earlier discussions of the university, or were you privy to the discussions between Coombs and Mills and others relating to tertiary education in the post-war world?
Not any great length until I went on to that committee. Certainly I'd read, I'm sure, I don't remember, but I'm sure I would have read, we all read the papers on major policy questions. I'm sure I would have read them, but I don't remember anything about them.
And you never spoke to Coombs, for example, about such questions?
Well, just one general thing that I do remember, one crucial thing, two crucial things maybe. The sequence with which the shape of the original ANU was made, I think that emerged clearly outside the committee and prior to my becoming a member, secretary, that the original idea was struck by Curtin, who wanted to have a school, a research school of social medicine established in Australia, established by the Commonwealth and established in Canberra. And his idea was that poor people were getting sick from, and like flu or whatever, and really there was no research being done on them, done on these things. And he wanted some institute that would devote itself to that. Now, that didn't look like much of a goer as a solitary outfit. And the next thing that came on the scene was proposition that there was the school, I've forgotten its precise title, the School of Pacific Administration in Sydney. And the argument there was, well, we could advance our imperialist cause by training colonial administrators. And so the idea of a school of Pacific studies, Pacific trading studies, really, they were all, both original notions were very pragmatic and practical, and nothing highfalutin about grand research involved in them. Those two things were well advanced, to my knowledge, before I got in the committee, and were discussed around the department. Now, I don't know when other ideas like bringing back the grand old scholars from overseas and Oliphant getting into the Act and so on, I don't know where they started. But those were the two things. But I do remember that once we got to the stage of seeing, this is again before I went on the committee, once we got to the stage of seeing that we had a sort of ragbag of colonial administrative training schemes, people looking into the ill health of the poor, and the adumbrations of something to do with nuclear science, that there was some funny little gap there, which was Australia itself in terms of social sciences. So the last thing that was thought about, in fact, was the School of Social Sciences. That was always quite clear in the agenda. But they came together as four schools and were tidied up into a more strictly academic bundle than was ever thought of at the beginning.
And when you became secretary of the committee, the academic bundle was there?
It was within the last 6 months of my being back in Canberra, and after all the Act, I think, for the ANU was passed in the beginning of 1946, so most of the work was done. There was still a good deal of argument, and I recall some of it, with Mills as the chair. Mills, whom I love dearly, and Coombs I love dearly, Mills in the chair, resisting the rather optimistic and revolutionary ideas that Coombs might have had, and Coombs needling mills and making bread in the face over, and having to concede almost all Coombs's arguments. There was no great love between those two, I don't think. Certainly, Coombs made Mills a very unhappy chairman, even though Mills really was the controller of tertiary education in Australia at the time. Coombs didn't concede an inch to him. But this was Coombs' style. He almost said he didn't realise what he was doing when he became Chancellor of the ANU. He behaved in the same way, and I think to the ANU's great benefit. I remember whenever the couple of times I was on council, Coombs would have the council meeting, usually at night, and then most of us who had remained the last dregs of the council meeting would troop into the Vice Chancellor's room. It was first Copeland and then Melville, and Coombs would drag out a couple of bottles of scotch and a few bottles of beer, and we would spend then 3 or 4 hours for a good deal of the rest of the night arguing vigorously about education, but Coombs always bubbling with ideas about what should be done about Australian education, tertiary education system. And I think he had tremendous influence, in fact, in the process.
Well, we should come back to that later, but Mills for the moment. Mills was one of the old school. I suppose you'd describe him as an old school historian, economic historian, whatever. How did he find himself in that position? Who appointed him, do you recall?
Well, it would have been because of his formal position in the tertiary education system. I can't tell I don't know the precise details how Mills got sequentially to that point, but at the University of Sydney, he was, as Professor of Economics, he was already also the official economic advisor of the New South Wales government, had been so for 15 or so years, and in fact paid a supplementary sum recorded in the budget for this purpose. I don't know what he did for it, but he had met, he'd been a right winger in his youth. An establishment man, really, rather than a right winger, I guess. But he was appointed to the Royal Commission on Money and Banking in 1936, and there he met Chifley. And he fell in love with Chifley. I think that's all I can say. I don't mean physically. I mean, he developed a tremendous admiration for him. And from certainly by the beginning of the war, he was an open Labor voter, and remained so for the rest of his life. Mossman notwithstanding, Mossman where he lived notwithstanding, which, during 1942 and 1943, the whole Faculty of Economics at Sydney University disintegrated. Walker went off to be Deputy Director General of War Organisation of Industry. My brother, Sid, went off to be Chief Economist. Swan went off to be Economist to Dedman. I'm a personal economist to Dedman. And even I was down there for 3 months as a student. But Mills was mixed up, first of all, with manpower planning and with Alf Conlon. They two of them really ran manpower, developed the policy for manpower planning actually within the four walls of Sydney University. And from that, Mills developed, we know that from writings by him and John Linnaeus, developed an ambition that everyone in Australia who had the intellectual capability should be able to do tertiary education. You don't answer that. And he moved then from the narrow manpower planning of the war to post-war education planning. And he was appointed, head of the Universities Commission. So he was in fact controlling the whole of the tertiary education and mobilised soldiers initially, and then developing schemes for scholarships and so on and so forth. So he was in fact the Lord High Poobah of tertiary education. By the time the active plans for the ANU came to the fore, so he would be the natural person to be the chairman of the outfit.
But his heart wasn't in it to the same extent that, or in the same way that Coombs's heart was.
No, I think actually that, well, Mills did say at one stage he was not at all sure whether, this was in fact one debate that was still going on when I was secretary. Mills did say he was not at all sure that we should make one central allocation of funds for one research body. He, after all, came from Sydney University, was well aware of what went on at Sydney University and equally at Melbourne University, whereas Coombs was not. Coombs had no background, really, in academia at all. I think Mills was probably torn between having one university, research university, or allocating funds to perhaps Sydney and Melbourne universities and dividing, making a substantial research addition to those two places. That was certainly a major policy debate, and one over which they had a considerable argument. Coombs won.
What about the other members of the committee?
I don't remember now. Sorry.
I think
Goods was one. He was always he was a Coombs man.
Sorry, who was that again?
Bert Goods from the Treasury. I don't remember meeting Eggleston, so I don't think he was, but maybe my bad memory. If I saw the papers again now, I could probably tell you again more, remember some of the things that people thought. But Bert Goods was certainly a Coombs man and a Canberra man, and he was certainly wholly in favour of the ANU, as Coombs was.
And had you reached the stage then when you felt you could actively contribute to the committee? Or were you there more or less still as the public service note taker?
I was essentially the bureaucrat, yeah. Mm.
And that continued, for a period of 3 months or thereabouts?
3 or 4 months, yeah.
Mm. And that would have been, three meetings?
Three or four, yeah. I think they met about once a month. Mm.
I think
the thing was really decided and all washed up, basically, by the time I got there. I think it was really that Finn Crisp, who'd been the active secretary, had got bored with it and said, well, there's a job that you could take over. That's all.
So you applied for the job in economic history in Sydney. First off, why did you apply for the job in... You would have applied for any job, okay, but it was a job in economic history rather than economics. Was that a natural progression for you?
That's what I'd always consciously wanted from the time I went to the university. that was the, for some reason, which is, well, no, it doesn't escape me. I'd gone to Sydney University as a pauper, so son of a pauper family, with the right to a bursary and scholarship and exhibition fees, let's say. But I had to be allocated to a faculty, and I'd got honours in, what was it, Latin, chemistry and French at the Leaving Institute. So I applied for science or arts, and the University of Sydney said, you can come here, but you can do economics. So I'd never heard of economics before, so it didn't interest me in the least. And I just sort of went through a token period of undergraduate years, and they were just monkey tricks as far as I was concerned, really. They were interesting monkey tricks, and I guess up to that point it was amusing, but it had no sense of reality to me that it would have had to, say, a son of a businessman or something of the sort. In that sense, it was just monkey tricks. And the only thing that had a degree of reality, and I stress the word degree, was in fact economic history, where you did seem to be dealing with the real world as well as some interesting problems. But that was wholly about the English manner. That was the only course in economic history I ever did. But it was enough to... We did also have to do a final honours year essay and we could choose what we wanted to do. And I chose to do one on Australian economic history and indeed on Edward Gibbon Wakefield, which was in fact one of Mills's special interests. But that was enough to make me think that's what I wanted to do the rest of my life. So you don't need much encouragement.
And presumably too, you were disinclined to a subject which was purely numbers. I mean, if you were doing Latin, for example, you would have had some interest in words.
Mm. Well, actually, most of my work has been numbers. No, I think that the problem and the strength of Sydney Faculty of Economics was that, let me draw a contrast. In Melbourne University, the PASS course was regarded as the primary thing to cope with, and honours was really, well, not quite a frill, but it was a sort of supplement. And it was intended to relate economics to the real world. And that gave Melbourne graduates a great strength, in particularly the public service, and they dominated the public service until the Second World War. And Sydney people only came in during the Second World War when they sort of moved to get people outside the Melbourne group. But Sydney emphasised, well, my brother Sid used to literally take the line, well, don't bother about the PASS course, just make sure you get 50%, or 49 anyway, I'm probably good enough, but concentrate on the honours course, which was a wholly separate sequence of classes, and we used to do weekly seminars where the object was not really to understand anything, but to criticise. And the whole object was to develop a critical faculty. And so we used to end up all these courses being able to tear a book or a series of articles to pieces, but not necessarily to be able to put anything together and to comprehend it. I remember at the end of the fourth year, Mills used to have a farewell party for the departing final year class. And two or three people usually asked to say something. And we used to play games and then go on to these little speeches, drink a little bit. And I had to say something on my occasion. And I remember saying that I was leaving the faculty. I'd enjoyed it, I said. I was careful about that. But I'd learnt how to criticise everything, but I didn't know how an economy was structured or how it functioned or how it changed as a whole. And I think that shocked Mills a bit. But it was certainly what I wanted to do. And that was really, for that one needs numbers, one needs national income estimates, and that's what I was doing later on. But I'd got enough of that from the bit of economic history that I did, and one or two other things, of course, in statistics, to realise that you could do something quite different. Now, I think the Sydney University Honours Course was a tremendously powerful course, but it was really aimed at people with more maturity than kids of 21, where you were really totally destructive. And later on I went to Harvard and saw how they could put together both a picture and a criticism and see the two as still in a holistic manner to a large extent. But Sydney wasn't able to do that.
So when you went to Sydney as a lecturer in economic history in 1946, you weren't able to vary significantly the way history, economics or economic history had been taught in the past?
I'd give it a totally free hand. No, there was no... sorry, don't think there was... don't think there was... a heavy hand laid on people. On the contrary, Mills, all of them, the whole ethos was freedom of thinking. And that's what the critical faculty was all about. You know, you go where your criticism leads you. Mills, of course, was really a historian lawyer, not an economist even, let alone an economic historian. He came by happenstance to Sydney. He was a Melbourne graduate, and when the chair became vacant in 1924, was it, when Irvin was sacked, Mills got it because, you know, there was no one better to take the job. He turned out to be an excellent choice. He learned economics on the job. He wrote a book on money with E.R. Walker, who came with several editions, but he had written a PhD thesis at London on Wakefield, and had was a highly intelligent man, certainly intelligent enough to put enough economics as well as history and law into his package on Wakefield, and to convey to people that, okay, there were these monkey tricks in economics, but then separate from that was economic history, and that was what he promoted. He always promoted, and it wasn't just that I saw the advantages of it. There was Mills, who then bred up Sid, my brother, imported John Lanois, appointed Bert Madgwick. These were the centre of the faculty, which I, nevertheless I repeat, were using all their influence to encourage people just to tear books on economics apart. It was a straight, they were working on their own research, but at the same time running these courses, which really had little relation to what their research was. So you got their encouragement to go in that direction. But it was a sort of encouragement in the future when you join the staff, you know, if you ever could. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to join the staff.
So you did join the staff, and you taught.
I was first given the task of giving a course which had never been given in Sydney on American economic history. So I was given 3 months off to read some books that I had to discover. Nobody knew what they should be. And so I taught a course on American economic history for 3 years, and then took on some Australian economic history.
Took on teaching Australian economic history at the end of that period?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just turn the tape over and we'll continue with Sydney after that.